These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled Foundations of Western Civilization 2, A History of the Modern Western World, Part 4. Lecture 37, The End of the War, 1917 to 1922.
We will trace the full implications of the Russian Revolution in subsequent lectures. For now, I want to remind you that it began as the beginning of the end of the Great War. In Russia, the Kaiser had fostered a revolution that went against everything he and his conservative regime stood for. He did that in a last-ditch attempt to win the war. In the end, the forces he unleashed would help to end the war, all right, but in a way that the Kaiser would find unpleasantly ironic, if the Kaiser were the sort of man to catch irony. As you will recall, German support for Lenin and the revolution had seemingly paid off in a virtual Russian surrender. Following Brest-Litovsk, the Germans transferred the bulk of their Eastern Army to the Western Front for an all-out assault on the Allied lines. This assault would be coordinated with new long-range heavy artillery, air reconnaissance, and bombing, including Germany's crack Jagdstaffel 11, led by the Red Baron himself, Manfred von Richthofen. But the 3 months that it took to negotiate Brest-Litovsk had been crucial to the Allies, enabling them to get fresh American troops under General John Blackjack Pershing to the front to cries of, "Lafayette, we are here." In fact, the German plan, devised by the brilliant General Erich Ludendorff, was to aim right for those troops stationed in the Argonne Forest. The artillery barrage began in late March 1918. German troops broke through and made it to within 50 miles of Paris. Once again, Paris was being shelled by German artillery. But the tired, veteran German troops ran into fresh American forces, who stiffened and held. By late May, the German offensive had stalled. The Allied counteroffensive began on 18 July. The exhausted German troops soon fell back. The 8th of August 1918 would go down in the history of the German army as Schwarztag, the Black Day of the German army. A new British invention, encouraged by Winston Churchill, the tank, enabled British forces in the northern sector to break through. They gained 8 miles. Now, 8 miles may not sound like very much. For most of us, it's a long walk or a short commute. But in the context of the Great War, in which millions of men had been expended just to gain a few hundred yards in either direction, it was vast. It was a continent. By late September 1918, German losses were 1 million men in 6 months, including the Red Baron, probably shot down by artillery fire. Morale was low, desertion was mounting. At home, there were food shortages, and communists demanding an end to the war attracted large crowds. That's what I meant about the ironic outcome of Wilhelm encouraging communism in Russia. The Austrians were losing resolve. Their emperor sent out repeated peace feelers to the Allies. Nationalist groups within the Austro-Hungarian Empire rose up and began to form armies of their own. But the key move would be made by the Imperial German Navy. Remember the Imperial German Navy? Kaiser Wilhelm's toy boat collection that increased taxes, helped cause the war, but proved fairly useless in winning it? After Jutland, the German high seas fleet had been holed up in port, blockaded by the British. Its ships rusted. Its men lost their fighting spirit. They complained about poor rations while the officers had champagne at dinner. They began to organize sailors' councils, the German equivalent of Soviets. At the end of October 1918, the high seas fleet was ordered to raise steam for a sortie. The rumor spread around the fleet that the high command intended one last glorious death ride against the British Grand Fleet. Perhaps not surprisingly, the sailors had other ideas. Why should they die for some chimerical glory when it was clear to anybody with eyes to see that the war was lost? So sailors on two battleships refused the order to sail. When they were arrested, a general mutiny broke out in the fleet on 3 November. At this point, early November, the command structure of the German and Austrian empires began to fall apart. On the 7th, revolts broke out in Bavaria. On the 9th, Kaiser Wilhelm abdicated. He fled to the Netherlands. Lucky for him that the Schlieffen Plan had been changed at the last minute to respect Dutch neutrality. He would live out his days on an estate at Doorn, surrounded by a small staff of loyal courtiers, he would write his memoirs. In them, he absolved himself of any responsibility for the most terrible war in European history, to date. 2 days later, Kaiser Karl, the last Austro-Hungarian emperor, gave up his constitutional powers. The German and Austrian provisional governments immediately sued the Allies for an armistice. Famously, the armistice was set to take place on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, November 11th, 1918. The Great War had ended. At its height, it had involved 34 nations. What was lost? 116,000 Americans, 322,000 Serbs, 325,000 Turks, 533,000 Italians, 1 million Britons and imperial troops, 1,050,000 Austrians and their imperial troops, 1,500,000 Frenchmen, 1,700,000 Russians, and finally 2 million Germans found their place in the sun. Also gone were four great empires, the German, the Austro-Hungarian, the Russian, and the Ottoman, after a revolt led by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in 1919. Also gone was a kind of innocent faith in kings and governments and elites, and even perhaps a good and loving God. From this, Europe has never recovered. As I have argued, the Great War was in many ways Europe's Vietnam, but perhaps much worse. What was gained? The rise of the USA to world prominence. The rise of the Soviet Union. The creation out of the old empires of numerous independent nation-states, many of them democracies, Poland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Yugoslavia. Though you'll note that in the case of the last two, different ethnic groups and cultures were still yoked together artificially. As well as the rise of new democratic governments in Germany, Austria, and Ireland following the Easter Rebellion of 1916 and the proclamation of dominion status by the British government in 1922. Also gained was the conviction and the hope that this would be the war to end all wars. That hope rested on the peace conference that assembled at Versailles in 1919. Now, the Versailles Conference, upon which we'll spend the bulk of the rest of this lecture, in many respects explains the political history of Europe for the next 20 years. It convened amid great optimism. There was a widespread conviction, much touted in the press, that the Allied leaders had a plan to make war itself a thing of the past. That plan was Woodrow Wilson's 14 points. Now, just as the Germans had been searching for a way out of the impasse of the Western Front early in 1918, so had Wilson. Wilson was a scholar and a former president of Princeton. In January of 1918, he'd drawn up a proposal to bring the Germans to the negotiating table and establish a basis for permanent peace. The result, the 14 points, was a rational and moderate attempt to reduce or eliminate many of the tensions that had led to the war. First, number one, point number one was open covenants of peace. That is, there were to be no more secret treaties a la Bismarck and Napoleon III. The second point was freedom of the seas. No more unrestricted warfare or even blockades. Number three was free trade. There were to be no tariff barriers among nations. Number four was disarmament to the lowest point consistent with domestic safety. Number five was the impartial arbitration of colonial disputes. The sixth point was Russian self-determination. From this point, the points address individual issues in Europe. And along with that, the evacuation of Allied troops from Russia. The seventh point said the same things about Belgium. The eighth point was that German troops should be withdrawn from France and that France was to receive back Alsace-Lorraine. The ninth was the adjustment of the Italian frontier to end border disputes with Austria. The tenth was autonomy for Hungary. The 11th, independence for Romania, Serbia, and Montenegro. The 12th was autonomy for the non-Turkish peoples of the Ottoman Empire. The 13th was independence for Poland, to include all the Polish peoples of Eastern Europe. And finally, the 14th point was the proposal of the formation of a General Association of Nations, quote, for the purpose of affording mutual guarantees of political independence and territorial integrity to great and small states alike. In other words, what Wilson was proposing was a League of Nations. Now, these proposals were prudent and reasonable. They took into account nationalistic aspirations ignored by the Congress of Vienna in 1815. They didn't assign guilt or blame for the war. They do not unduly punish Germany or Austria-Hungary. But were they practical? Remember that they were written in January 1918, before Germany lost the war. The idea at the time was to persuade the Germans that it was worth coming to the bargaining table. But if you may have noticed that Germany's bargaining position had deteriorated considerably since then. Wilson was an idealist, for he could afford to be. Remember that the United States had not experienced the war on its own soil. The other Allied leaders, above all, Georges Clemenceau, the President of France, and David Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, came from very different places. A good third of France had been occupied and turned into wasteland by the Imperial German Army. France lost 1 million buildings and 6,000 bridges during the war. The French already harbored bitter and humiliating memories from their defeat in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71. Clemenceau hated the Germans, and his people wanted the Boche punished and their power reduced to a point that they could never again cross into the Ardennes. Nor were the British in much of a forgiving mood. Lloyd George privately agreed with Wilson. He said, "We shall have to fight another war again in 25 years' time." But he just won an election on a promise of a harsh peace. And so in the end, Wilson the idealist was outmaneuvered by Clemenceau and Lloyd George, the realists practicing Realpolitik. Unlike the Congress of Vienna, where France was an equal participant, Germany was not even invited to be part of the negotiations. German diplomats would only be summoned to accept or reject the final document. This would be the basis for subsequent German charges that the Treaty of Versailles was a diktat, a dictated peace. And in fact, the resulting settlement was far more harsh than anything Wilson had in mind. Take the territorial settlement. Germany lost significant amounts of territory. That was predictable, in part to give its neighbors buffer zones. Alsace-Lorraine went back to France. The Rhineland, including the Saar Valley, the very heart of the German coal industry, was to be demilitarized for 15 years and its coal production sent to France. Much of East Prussia went to help form Poland. However, Danzig, Gdansk, remained in German hands, a sore spot, forming a little island of Germany within Polish territory. In the end, in effect, Germany lost 13% of its population, 15% of its coal, 50% of its iron ore, and 20% of its iron and steel industry. It was also stripped of its overseas empire. Britain, Japan, and the U.S. were given mandate rights over former German possessions. Later treaties broke up the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, the last legacy of Habsburg intermarriage. Austria-Hungary was broken up into Austria and Hungary, and Czechoslovakia, lumping together Czechs and Slovaks, and Yugoslavia, lumping together Serbs, Croats, and Bosnian Muslims. The idea here was that if you gave these individual peoples their own countries, those countries would be too small to withstand the onslaught of their neighbors. Other Austrian territory went to Poland and Italy. Bulgaria lost territory in the Aegean, and the Ottoman Empire lost all of its overseas possessions. Remember that Lawrence of Arabia had promised Arabs in Iraq, Syria, and Palestine, who had rebelled against the Ottoman Empire, that they would be given self-determination, the right to have their own countries. But that promise was broken at Versailles. Instead, Britain was to administer Iraq and Palestine as protectorates. France was to do so for Syria, thus undoing a political arrangement that had been intact since the Crusades. Arab peoples traded one occupier for another. So the territorial settlement of Versailles and associated treaties only partly fulfilled the goals set for it by the 14 points. Old defeated empires were broken up, but others, Britain, France, were strengthened. Some peoples, Poles, Baltic peoples, did achieve statehood, but others were lumped together in uneasy, ramshackle states, Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, for example. So the principle of national self-determination, itself an implication of nationalism, was only partly fulfilled at Versailles. It was trumped by the older principle of balance of power. Germany and the Soviet Union had to be counterbalanced, even if that meant lumping Czechs and Slovaks, Serbs, Croats, and Bosnian Muslims together. Nor was imperialism repudiated. Germany lost her empire, all right, but Britain and the France and the United States augmented theirs. Which reminds me of a famous story. Remember that Versailles was seen as a great opportunity to end forever the endemic causes of wars, but also for many colonized and subject peoples, it was a chance for independence. And so the great and the good, the hopeful and the idealistic, dreamers and fools, the representatives from scores of peoples across the globe, official and unofficial, flocked to Versailles and sought to get in a word edgewise. Today, we call these people lobbyists. One such was a young Asian immigrant living in Paris as a photographic retoucher. He'd been influenced by the lofty ideals of the American and French revolutions, as well as the writings of Karl Marx, and he'd been inspired by the events in Russia. Yet he was hopeful that Wilson, who had called for self-determination in the 14 points, would listen to the aspirations of his people, who had been a part of the French Empire for half a century. He actually went to the trouble of renting a top hat and cutaway coat to make the best possible impression at the conference. The young man asked for an appointment to make a formal proposal to Wilson, but Wilson or one of his secretaries, it's unclear, refused the insignificant little man from the far-off country in Asia that no American had ever heard of. That country was Vietnam. And that man who would never forget his treatment by an American president was Ho Chi Minh. You think maybe we should have listened? Versailles would not solve the nationalist or the imperialist problem. And that failure would spell lots and lots of future trouble, not only for the nations of Europe. Second came the military settlement. Now here, the main idea was to defang Germany, not to disarm the whole world. And we begin to see a sense that the negotiators of Versailles think the problem is Germany. It's not everybody else. So as we've seen, the Rhineland was to be occupied by Allied troops for 15 years. The German army was to be reduced to 100,000 men from a height of 13 million men during the war. So it essentially becomes a national police force. Germany was forbidden to have an air force. And the German navy, once consisting of over two dozen proud dreadnoughts of over 25,000 tons, was to be reduced to six small coastal battleships of about 10,000 tons. U-boats were verboten. Nor would the Germans have the economic resources to rearm. Third came the economic provisions of Versailles. Again, the idea was to render Germany incapable of starting another war, but also to recompense the Allies for the cost of the war. And it's here especially that we begin to see the more sinister themes of punishment and humiliation in the Treaty of Versailles. As we've seen, German coal was to be shipped to France. German merchant ships were awarded to the Allies. Foreign assets and patents were forfeit. That's how the Germans lost the rights to Bayer aspirin, only recently restored. Finally, Germany was to pay an indemnity of $5 billion and reparations of $32 billion to the Allies. Now, clearly, Germany would not be spending any more money on weaponry anytime soon. But just as clearly, the Allies were trying to recoup their costs and pay off their massive debt to America on the backs of the defeated Germans. Equally clearly, in seizing much of German heavy industry, all of Germany's coal, and saddling Germany with immense reparations costs, the Allies had just made it virtually impossible for the Germans to actually pay those costs. They weren't going to be able to afford to pay their reparations. But the ultimate humiliation of the Versailles Treaty was the infamous War Guilt Clause. The War Guilt Clause is contained in Article 231 of the Versailles Treaty, which states, "The Allied and associated governments affirm, and Germany accepts, the responsibility of Germany and her allies for causing all the loss and damage to which the Allied and associated governments and their nationals have been subjected as a consequence of the war imposed upon them by the aggression of Germany and her allies. Now, you can argue about the territorial settlement and the military settlement and the economic settlement, but the world had seen punitive peace settlements before. This, in some ways, was just desserts for Bismarck's treatment of France in 1871. And recently, some historians have argued that the territorial and military settlements between Germany and Europe were a reasonable response to the German challenge and the nationalistic aspirations of non-Germans. But the War Guilt Clause was something else. For the first time, a national blame has been assigned as a cause for war. For the first time, the community of nations seems to want to impose a sense of national disgrace. Now, in fact, as we've seen, the Kaiser's military buildup, his swaggering aggressiveness, the blank check to Austria did contribute to the causes for World War I. But so did Serbian terrorism and Russian aggressiveness in the Balkans and French resentment of Germany. The British sense of naval entitlement, who said that they get to have the biggest navy? And their hesitation over honoring its treaty obligations. In general, it could be argued that European imperialism, militarism, and nationalism had all caused the war. The question of who started World War I or who was most responsible would become a favorite of historians between the wars, and it has become a typical undergraduate essay question since. But Versailles' answer, combined with the peculiar circumstances that the German army had not been entirely beaten in the field, no Allied soldier had crossed German borders, and that no German diplomat had been consulted at Versailles, but rather summoned to sign the document on a take-it-or-leave-it basis on the 7th of May, 1919, all contributed to German resentment and the sense that the Second Reich had been stabbed in the back. That idea will come back to haunt us in lecture after lecture. So in conclusion on Versailles, Versailles was, like the Congress of Vienna, at best an incomplete solution to the problems that had led to the Great War. It largely ignored what had happened in Russia, establishing a policy among Western governments of simply shunning the new communist regime. This was perhaps understandable given the communist rhetoric about international revolution and also given the widespread revulsion at the murder of the Tsar's family. It was understandable, but it was unwise in the long run. It left the Soviet Union isolated and paranoid. Versailles only partly solved the problem of nationalism. Ethnic tensions would continue to play a part in the problems of the 1920s and 30s. For example, Sudeten Germans given to Czechoslovakia, living in Czechoslovakia, Prussians living in Poland, who all wanted to be part of Germany. The colonial problem had not been solved by Versailles for reasons we've already addressed, and the economic provisions were simply unworkable, as we have seen. Finally, the War Guilt Clause added insult to injury. On the one hand, it declared that Germany was a pariah, the sole cause for all the world's troubles. But now, Germany was somehow expected to be a good neighbor, a democracy, a bulwark for resisting communism to the east. That treatment would only be exploited by German politicians of the left and the right, and so Versailles created as many tensions as it solved. There was perhaps only one glimmer of hope, the only one of Wilson's 14 points that remained on the table when the conference closed, the League of Nations. The League of Nations was chartered in 1919. Its purpose was to promote international cooperation and to achieve international peace and security. It was to do this through four specific functions. First, international disarmament. Second, arbitration of international disputes. This would be a place where you could solve problems without resorting to war. Third, economic sanctions against aggression. And fourth, treaty revision. So there was always the hope that Versailles could be redone in the light of experience. Now, before we examine the successes and failures of the League of Nations, we need to note two fundamental flaws right from the very beginning. First, there was no provision in the Charter for the use of military force. All disputes were to be resolved through nonviolent means. Now, this was a worthy goal. It was utterly understandable after the carnage of the Great War, but it was equally utterly unrealistic. The second problem with the League of Nations was that right at the start, three of the major players were missing. The Soviet Union wasn't invited to join. Germany was excluded. Remember, it's a pariah nation. The USA chose not to join. Upon his return to the United States, Wilson campaigned hard to convince Congress to ratify the Versailles Treaty and the League Charter. In fact, the stress of the cross-country barnstorming campaign probably brought on the stroke that incapacitated Wilson in October of 1919. But Republican senators and congressmen opposed further involvement in European affairs. They wanted a return to normalcy. They wanted to return to isolation. Let Europe solve Europe's problems. We help them. That's over now. They won the argument, and so the U.S. stayed out of the League of Nations. So with two hands tied behind its back, the League first convened in Geneva on the 5th of November, 1920. Now, the first matter on the agenda was international disarmament. The hope was that now that Germany was disarmed, other nations would feel that they could reduce their stockpiles of weapons. So again, we're kind of caught in this mindset that it's all Germany's fault. If you can just neutralize Germany, everybody else will behave. In 1921 and 1936, naval disarmament conferences were held in Washington and London, respectively. And they were pretty successful. The British, the Americans, and the Japanese Navy, the remaining battleship powers, if you will, agreed to a ratio of 5-5-3 in capital ships. For every five ships the British built, the Americans could have five, and the Japanese could have three. By the way, the Japanese complained about this. They wanted to be considered an equal. Apparently, one of the Japanese representatives to the conference was heard muttering, Rolls-Royce, Cadillac, Ford, which is an interesting comment on the degree to which Western brand names had already permeated Japanese culture. The naval conferences also agreed on a moratorium on building new ships until 1931 and to scrap most of the old battle fleets. But they came to no agreement on submarines or aircraft, which, of course, represented the wave of the future in naval warfare, so they were a limited success. There was a 1932 conference on military disarmament, that is, armies, which was held in Paris, but it couldn't reach agreement. No one could figure out a reasonable formula to measure a country's land forces needs. Geographical area? Size of your population? The wealth of your country? Could you base the size of your army on whether you had aggressive neighbors? In other words, were you entitled to a bigger army if you were next to Germany? Now, given continued distrust of Germany and the growing anxiety in the West about Japan and the Soviet Union, and vice versa, who really wants to disarm anyway? Now, in fact, during the 20s and 30s, the great nations of Europe did reduce their wartime forces. They mainly did that for economic considerations, but they reserved the right to build them up again as they felt they needed them. The second matter on the agenda for the League of Nations was arbitration of international disputes. And generally, that worked out pretty well when the two countries were small and relatively powerless. Finland versus Sweden over the Åland Islands in 1921. Or Greece versus Bulgaria over a border dispute in 1925, these the League of Nations could solve. But larger, more powerful countries simply ignored the international community when it suited them, as they often tend to do today. In 1923, Italy under Benito Mussolini annexed the island of Corfu. In the next year, France marched into the Ruhr because the Germans fell behind on their reparations payments. Now, since the League had no army or access to members' military forces, the only recourse was economic sanctions, with similarly dismal results with which we're all too familiar. They failed to solve the Bolivian-Paraguayan War of 1932. In 1936, Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. Ethiopia's embattled emperor, Haile Selassie, made an impassioned speech at the League of Nations, and economic sanctions on Italy were voted on a wide range of commodities, excluding oil. Why? Because Britain and France needed Libyan oil, which at the time was controlled by Italy. So Italy got off, if not scot-free, fairly completely. Does this sound familiar? Finally, the League of Nations offered the possibility of treaty revision, the possibility that Versailles and other treaties could be revisited. And indeed, in the 1920s and 30s, this was used to ease the German situation somewhat. We'll talk more about that in the next lecture. Now, hindsight is 20/20, and because we know that World War I was not the war to end all wars, the League of Nations and the Treaty of Versailles have been viewed as failures, and I've largely presented them that way in this lecture. Certainly, many of the tensions which led to World War I were not solved by Versailles or the League. Certainly, the harsh treatment of Germany and the partial accommodation of nationalism did contribute to World War II. But the Treaty of Versailles did put Europe back together, and often under democratic regimes after the utter chaos of the war. It is not always clear how the negotiators at Versailles could have done better. The League of Nations did have some successes. Naval disarmament. It attacked international traffic in narcotics and prostitution. It assisted refugees at the end of World War I. It addressed health and labor conditions on a global scale for the first time. Gradually, through treaty revision, it brought Germany and the Soviet Union back into the Brotherhood of Nations. Germany joined in 1926, Russia in 1934. And it provided a precedent for global cooperation, which forms a link, say, between the Holy Alliance and the United Nations. But both the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations would be overwhelmed by the economic, social, and political tensions of the 1920s and 30s. The war to end all wars was misnamed. It was rather the prequel to an uneasy intermission and a more terrible sequel.